Nerds Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nerds Netter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, so hello, Steve, and welcome to Nailers Natter, and welcome to Teacher Hug Radio.
Well, hello, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, now, before we get into the podcast, we're just going to talk about it. So often I interview people and we say that, you know, you haven't necessarily met them, especially in the virtual world. Now, Steve will not remember this for £1 million. He will not remember this. But however, I have briefly met him. Listener, I have briefly met him and he's looking down the camera thinking, when did this happen? So I'll see whether he can remember. This was Research Ed Rugby in a taxi from the station, as I remember. There we go. So it's great to see you again. And we're going to talk today about your book. So we're going to look at Beyond Wiping Noses, which is Steve's book on building an informed approach to pastoral leadership in schools. And this is kind of a recurring theme that we've been going on Teach Hug Radio and on the podcast recently, because we feel as if we need to shine a little bit more of a spotlight on pastoral work and the kind of the people that work within it. So before we get into talking to Steve, I'm just going to read one of the reviews quickly, if that's okay, listener. And this is from Adam Boxer, who's talking about the use of evidence and research, but also this for me really distills and sums up the kind of move that we need in pastoral work and evidence-based practice and the link between the two. So Adam says, amongst the clamour of noise surrounding cognitive science, evidence-based practice and knowledge-rich curricula, little to no mention has been made of the pastoral dimension to education. Despite the slow emergence of the academic side of teaching into the light of research and evidence, pastoral work seems rooted in folk wisdom and gut instinct. This remarkable work by Stephen Lane bridges that gap, tying together these different worlds in a clear and well-researched book. So high praise indeed, Steve. So
yes,
welcome.
Indeed. I never did give him that 20 quid.
But like I said, this is something that we've been revisiting quite a few times on the podcast, talking about, you know, kind of tying those two things together. So listeners will know that, you know, through the work that I was doing with the research school movement and Teacher Development Trust on CPD, this is something that we're really interested in. Plus, you know, the day-to-day work of the busy pastoral deputy. So I'm really interested to talk to you about this book today. Okay, so if we get into the book, and Steve, we go with chapter one about pastoral roles. So you've kind of talked about all the different roles within there. And the first one we're going to look at, if we can, is the role of the form tutor. So tell us a little bit about the role of the form tutor and its importance.
Well, there's obviously different ideas and approaches to the form tutor, but essentially for me, the form tutor provides a really important kind of buffer between the not school world and the school world. And for some children, you know, that's going to be an important sort of transition zone, I guess. Well, for all of them, perhaps. And certainly from, you know, having been out in the playground, having a chat about what's happened last night, what's been on the telly, what's been on the latest TikToks and things, to then come in ready for a lesson, the first lesson of the day. And I know some schools go straight into a first period. And I always wonder, that for the teacher of that first period, if there's not been that form time, whether there's an increased demand in terms of behaviour management, in terms of settling the students down to learning, because they've not had that form time. So that's the first element of it. Secondly, I think that, boring though it is, there is a sort of administrative element to it, I guess, which is just making sure that, you know, attendance has been recorded accurately and those sorts of things. But more importantly than all of that is this idea of social cohesion, and something which isn't directly linked to sort of rigorous academic subject learning, but that there's something more fundamentally human about that. And actually, a lot of the time, that's about learning some of those social skills that, and developing those social skills that I think we all need to develop. And again, as I said, there's different approaches. For some schools, the form time is relatively relaxed and laid back. It's a time for a bit of chat, a bit of banter, perhaps, that the form tutor will perhaps participate in. And that helps to establish that teachers are human too, and to establish that kind of approachable aspect of being a form tutor. For some schools, they may decide that actually that form period needs to be a little more focused, and they'll maybe have some literacy focus in there. They'll maybe do some drop everything and read type stuff in there. And for some schools, there may it may be, you know, anywhere on the spectrum between those. For us, at the place that I work, there's often assemblies in that form period time. So they actually are in form period, depending on the week, two or three times a week, and then they'll be in assemblies. Of course, we're not having whole school assemblies at the moment. And again, I think that's a really important part of developing school community, a sense of social cohesion across a year group or across a whole school. I am a big fan of communal singing, and I think that I don't know how many mainstream state schools still do that. I think it's something that certainly that might, in the period of time that I was in the state sector, it seemed to diminish away from assemblies, that it wasn't happening so much. And I think that was a real shame. I'd love to see schools bringing singing back into their assemblies. So it's really just about that social cohesion and those social skills and that buffer zone between being not at school and being at school, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, in terms of how the role has been integral to the kind of return to school recently as well, it's really important that, you know, form teachers are kind of recognised and the importance of that form teacher period. And well, as you said there, that there's not necessarily the need to do something within that form period. It's just a way of, you know, making sure that you are ready to learn when you get into school.
That's right. And of course, I mean, the role of the form tutor extends well beyond the form period. It's a first port of call for students and for parents. And also for if a teacher, a subject teacher has perhaps got a question or a concern about a kid, then the form tutor would be the first point of call. You know, the kid didn't seem quite right today. There's a little bit something off. And the form tutor would be the one that would have that overview of each of the students in their form. So they might know that there's something that's happened at home or whatnot, and they've got that overall picture. And the form tutor will be the one that maybe the kid will come and talk to at break time or lunchtime. And I think that point of contact is so important. And having somebody who has an overview of each student's well-being and progress across the board. One of the other things that happens in a lot of schools is that when you do a reporting season, and all the subject teachers have put their reports together for each individual kid, often the form tutor is the one that does the first sort of stage of checking, if you like. They'll read through all of the reports and put their comment on as well. And that's part of that whole overview aspect that a form tutor should have, I think, of the students in their tutor group.
Yeah, definitely. Now, the next section was really interesting to me in the head of year, because the head of year role has gone through many iterations, hasn't it, certainly over my kind of teaching career. It was, you know, the absolute go-to role when I first started teaching, and kind of for me as somebody who wanted to work within pastoral and really enjoyed the kind of form tutor work, was the next kind of route through in terms of the pastoral. But I've seen the iterations have been from anything from, you know, teaching heads of year to non-teaching heads of year to various different types of heads of year. So what do you think, Steve, in terms of the importance of the head of year? What are the roles within that? And, you know, what kind of things are they expected to do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, it's kind of all things, isn't it?
I just realised when I said that, listener, that we could be here till about 10 o'clock, couldn't we, talking about that?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I say in the book is actually when you look at job descriptions for head of year, I mean, often specifically head of year posts don't come up all that often, actually. But the responsibilities that lie with the head of year are incredibly varied from school to school. But again, it is having that sense of overview. It's having a point of contact. It is about having that next layer up. And often the head of year is somebody who is overseeing the behaviour of a particular year group or a couple of year groups. And so they'll be the ones who have to perhaps deal with the slightly more serious pastoral issues when kids fall out, but they'll also be the ones that have to deal with behaviour issues when a kid is not getting their behaviour quite right in one or two subjects. It'll be the head of year usually that steps in and deals with that. And the one thing that we've not mentioned yet, which we really need to mention, of course, is safeguarding. I mean, all members of staff in a school are, of course, frontline safeguarding personnel. But often the head of year will be the one that things, even if they're not necessarily a DSL, there will be ones that things get referred to. And some schools, the head of year will also oversee maybe PSAG for a particular year group. They may be in charge of what's happening in assemblies. One of the chapters later on in the book is about curriculum matters. And so when we get to that, I'll probably refer back to this comment, but that whole sense, again, of overview of what the assemblies might, the curriculum of the assemblies across a term or across a year. And as I said, they might be in charge of PSHE. So in some schools, they might be the ones who are mental health champions and all those sorts of things. There's various different, it might look very different in certain schools, just like perhaps some of the other roles. I think the head of year is probably the one that's most varied actually as a role across different schools.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, in terms of how it's changed over time, I mean, I always say how long I've been teaching for now. So, you know, we're talking 20 plus years, but when I was first head of year, early 2000s, it was a very different role to how it is now, because obviously you were still expected to juggle your teaching responsibilities with the pastoral responsibilities. But how can I put this diplomatically? There wasn't as much emphasis on your quality of teaching if you were head of year. So, you know, you may well be finding yourself trying to get to a class 5-10 minutes late, accompanied by about 10 other students who you were sitting at the back of your classroom whilst trying to teach and learn. Yes. I think that's and that's the reason.
And just as that lesson starts, you get a call come through that some serious safeguarding issue has erupted, and there's a cover teacher on the way to take your class. Please be, you know, in a meeting with a parent or something. And that's the other thing about, I mean, pastoral in general, but when you start sort of working up the levels of management into head of year level and SLT pastoral leadership, it's the uncertainty of it, it's the unpredictability of it, which is part of the joy of it. You never know what one day is going to be like, but it is also one of the stressors, obviously, of that kind of work, that you just don't know necessarily what's going to come your way. And so much of what we do as pastoral leaders is reactive, is ad hoc as a response to that. And that's what makes it so very challenging, I think.
Definitely. And that's what's good about this book, Steve, is that you've been able to talk about that in terms of your experience of that. But then in the next chapter, you've been able to tie that to the best available academic research and evidence that's talking about those kind of roles. So it's a big question, but obviously it's something that you address in the chapter two. You know, where can listeners find the best pastoral research?
Yeah, and this was the reason that this kind of book came about was actually I was doing talks at Research Ed, as you've mentioned, and I used to do talks about, you know, Foucault, and I used to do talks about the language of teaching job adverts and things. And it was when I was going to one of the Research Ed Brum, and Claire, who organises that, asked me, you know, she said, it would be really good to see, you know, how you use research in your pastoral role. And I came away from that thinking, actually, how do I use research in that role? And generally, we don't. And so that came to the question then of, okay, so if I'm going to use research, what, first of all, what kind of research is applicable? What kind of research might I actually want to look at? So the chapter also deals with some of those ideas about just trying to come to terms with what's considered to be rigorous and relevant research.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers with Teacher Hug Radio, the soundtrack to your teaching career.
Because a lot of the discourse around research informed education is about, you know, testable repeatable research findings and things. And so often that's to do with the science of learning, it's to do with pedagogy, it's to do with interventions that can be utilized across the board, whereas those things don't seem to be quite so applicable somehow to, or at least that's what I thought. So the first question really was just looking at what kind of research would count as valuable research, then that leads on to, and where do we find it? And there's various places. I mean, if you're a member of the Chartered College of Teaching, obviously you've got access to a whole bunch of journals through their search tool there. But I came across a particularly useful journal, which is the Journal of the National Association of Pastoral Care and Education. And their journal is pretty good. And as I would strongly recommends becoming a member of that association, following them on Twitter at the very least, and a whole wide range of things that they look into. The following chapters in the book kind of pick up on some of these ideas about where research related to certain issues might arise, but a starting point, that searchable database at the Chartered College and the National Association for Pastoral Care and Education are really good starting points.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, in terms of the work that we did as a research school, and we did a lot of work on, as you've mentioned about, you know, effect sizes becoming critical consumers of evidence and research. Yes. But obviously the people that we had in front of us, and this is a sweeping generalization, so I'm just going off a kind of what we had, was generally people who were curriculum leaders, generally people who were involved in the kind of academic side of it. And yeah. I can't recall particularly, unless they were wearing more than one hat, anybody from a pastoral kind of side of things coming in. So you've done some links around Rosenshine's principles of instruction and cognitive load theory. So tell us, Steve, how have you kind of woven those into the pastoral aspect of your job?
So with, I'll start with the second one, the cognitive load theory. You know, if it is true, as Willingham says, that this is the most important thing that teachers could know, then that's not just applicable to the class, the subject classroom, but it's also going to be applicable to the PSHE classroom. It's going to be subject to applicable to the form time. It's going to be applicable to whatever messages we want to give students through assemblies. And actually, one of the things that I noticed when I was sitting in assemblies in years gone by is often the sheer amount of stuff that gets thrown at kids in the space of a 10 or 15 minute assembly, or in the space of a 10 or 15 minute form time, because suddenly loads of teachers have really important messages that they've got to give the kids about meetings that they've got to have for the sports club, or rehearsals for the drama club, or the room changes that they've got coming up that day. And actually, it's just overwhelming. Now, I, as an adult, would come out of those rooms not having a clue what any of that, I've just not been able to remember any of it. If you're a kid in year 7, year 8, year 9, year 11, and you've got other stuff going on in your mind, then talk about cognitive overload. So actually, really, it's just about, you know, stripping down to what are the kind of key messages that we want in any given period of time as students to gain from that. So I think that's where the CLT stuff is applicable. And similarly with Rosenshine, there's no reason why those principles couldn't be applied in things like assemblies, for example. So if you are having an assembly with a particular year group, it may well be that that assembly starts off with, if you may remember that last week we were talking about, and there's connecting with prior learning, and it might be that you deliver messages in particular chunks and that you repeat those chunks. So it's really kind of thinking about how you can apply those to areas outside of the kind of subject disciplines.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, really. So, I mean, this is something that that I've been working on quite a lot recently, about kind of joining up the day-to-day safeguarding, the day-to-day behaviours with, as you said, you know, the planned curriculum for PSHE, the planned curriculum for RSE as well now, and all the other things there. But what I like about the next bit of the chapter is you've talked about how you can make that pastoral curriculum knowledge rich, and you've talked also about the kind of hidden curriculum. Yes. So tell us a little bit more about that.
So this the idea with the hidden curriculum is, you know, thinking about what do kids learn during the day that isn't part of the planned, you know, learning outcomes. What are they learning from each other on the playground? What are they learning about from each other on the corridors? What are they learning from the adults in the building through the way that the adults behave, the way that adults speak to them, the way that adults speak to each other? And actually beginning to think, well, we need to unpick this a little bit and making these things a bit more deliberate. So if we want, I have this real kind of thing about holding doors open, right? To me, holding doors open and saying thank you to somebody who's held the door open for you are real kind of signifiers of a polite civilization. It really frustrates me when you're out and about and it doesn't happen. So But if I want my kids in my school to do that, then I need to model it. I need to make sure that my staff are modeling it. I need to acknowledge when the kids are doing it and saying thank you to them for when they're doing it. So it's these little behaviors that it ties in with behavior management. It ties in with the whole thing about creating a culture. You have to sweat the small things, I suppose, but you have to be explicit in your own mind about what those small things are. And there's so many things in a school day that we kind of leave to chance, really. And that's not to say necessarily that we need to have silent corridors everywhere and that sort of thing necessarily, but it's thinking through at this point in the day, what are these kids learning from what's happening in this school?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it is. And I mean, in terms of following that on to a particular context, you've talked about bullying in the next chapter, haven't mm-hmm. you? So you've talked about how you can use, again, some of that research around what kind of intervention strategies that you can use. So if you don't mind kind of outlining the different kinds of bullying that you've talked about, and then maybe some ways that you've suggested that you can intervene with those.
Yeah, so the chapter really was born out of things that I'd been experiencing within my own setting and things that I'd experienced within prior teaching settings, where it was kind of driven really, I suppose, by the fact that the word bullying kind of gets used quite a bit. Often you might get an email or a phone call from a parent saying, oh, my kid's being bullied. And when you dig down into that a little bit, you start to think, well, actually, is this bullying? And what is the definition of bullying? And it's quite staggering to discover that there is no kind of official, certainly governmental official, definition of bullying. We all seem to agree that it's targeted and that it's repeated. But even those terms are kind of slippery if you're talking about things that have happened, I don't know, on social media, for example, or online. One kid might have posted something unpleasant about another kid once. So from their perspective, that's not repeated. But that thing might have got shared, screenshots might be getting shared, it might be getting retweeted and all those sorts of things. So from the perspective of the victim, suddenly it is very much so repeated. So these terms can be slightly slippery, really. And one of the things that really helped me with the work that I was doing was to think in terms of the language that we were using, because a lot of times what you've got, actually, rather than it being targeted harassment and bullying in that classical sense, what you've often got is students, two or more students who have got relational conflict, and the role of aggressor and the role of victim sometimes swap round between those players, between the actors within that. And so actually, and one of the things that we were doing at my place was when we were logging those on our safeguarding system, we were using the term friendship issues. And it dawned on me, these kids have never been friends. They're not having friendship issues. And actually, I'm never going to get them to be friends. And that's maybe not the outcome that I'm after. The outcome that I'm after is for them to stop being horrible to each other. And that's not necessarily the same as being friends. And so one of the things that came out of my reading was the term conflict and the term peer conflict and the term relational conflict. And that actually, just that turn of phrase helped us in the way that we were dealing with some issues that we were experiencing in my setting between a small group of students. And it also enabled us to then work with those students in a much more productive manner, because you weren't labeling any one of them as a bully necessarily, but you were talking about it in terms of peer conflicts, which is more perhaps useful. I would like to mention the work of Dr. Nassem, who wrote a book about bullying, which was really, really useful and really kind of opened my eyes to the nature of bullying and the nature of peer conflict between people, and also the real important aspects of bullying, which is around the role of the bystander and the whole thing so these two kids, their names have been given to me, but who else was there? And if you log all of the names of whoever else has been there, sometimes you start to see patterns. that there's maybe one or two people on the sidelines who are never directly involved, but somehow always seem to be there. And you actually start to say, well, actually, there's some manipulation going on here that we wouldn't otherwise have been aware of if we weren't logging those things. So part of that then, in terms of actual daily practice, it's about making sure that when you record things, you record as many specific details about who's been involved in any given incident as you can, so that you can start to spot patterns.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, Steve, isn't it, in terms of not just the logging of people, but the logging of those incidents. So you mentioned that you use particular safeguarding software, and we don't need to get into the ins and outs of which one, but it enables you presumably then to identify trends and patterns of what kind of issues you're having. So you've used about conflict, relational bullying, and then that can feed back into the knowledge-rich pastoral curriculum, can't it? Because while you've got your fixed assembly points, you're able to be adaptable and flexible enough to respond to things as they're happening in your setting.
That's right. And one of the things that the software that we use, and I know this is true of other platforms too, is that the child who, let's say, is the victim of a bullying incident, for example, you enter their name and they are the sort of name for whom the incident has been generated. But there's a box there for you to add other names too. And so that if you were then to search that other, any of those other names, that incident then flags up on their record, if you like, too. And that's really, really important, having that cross-identification of individuals who've been involved in any particular incident so that you can see those patterns.
Into chapter 5, we talk about wellbeing, mental health and attachment. So what do you think is the role of schools within that kind of remit?
Yeah, so it's, again, you know, some commentators on, you know, on Twitter will have you think that schools are purely academic institutions, and there's a danger that schools end up trying to play too many roles, that teachers end up having to be counsellor, having to be nurse, having to be all sorts of different roles that we're not trained for, ultimately. Particularly in the sort of secondary sector, where, you know, you're trained as subject specialists and you teach as subject specialists. But actually, it's quite clear that schools do have a very important and significant role to play in matters of well-being. And I was glad to see that the government announced their expectation that every school should have a mental health champion, for example. You know, mental health is increasingly something that is on our radar, and it's something that we've got to take seriously. Well-being is something that we've got to take seriously. The danger, I guess, is that schools could say, yes, well, we'll appoint so-and-so as the mental health champion, and they can have it just as part of their, you know, head of your TLR or as part of their something else.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Join in the conversation on hashtag TeacherHugRadio or call the show on 0800 246 1555.
And there'll be some tick box exercises to say that will happen. But, you know, it needs to be taken far more seriously than that, and it needs to be kind of ingrained in the culture. The bit of the book of this chapter that kind of opened my eyes a little bit was the stuff on attachment theory. So some of the commentators on social media have been slightly dismissive of ideas around attachment. But actually, a lot of those criticisms of attachment theory are really based on the kind of early years of the development of attachment theory. And when you actually start to think in terms of attachment theory as being something that attachment isn't just an issue for those young children who have had a diagnosis of attachment disorder, okay? We all have attachment needs. And once you sort of start to recognize the fact that everybody has attachment needs, that starts to give you a slightly different perspective on many, many areas of school practice, even acknowledging that teachers have attachment needs. And that can affect the way that we interact with our classes, the way that we respond to behaviour issues. You know, so often we take it personally. So that whole work on attachment theory really sort of opened my eyes a little bit. So I'd strongly recommend a read of that chapter to anybody, because I think people who know me on Twitter might be surprised to see my take on attachment theories.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, in terms of other links, again, to research, you've talked about the use of direct instruction, project follow through, self-esteem and prayer. So how have you linked that back into well-being and mental health?
So the project follow through stuff, unfortunate name, isn't it, project follow through? But it's really fascinating when you look at the findings. This is a project which is still regarded, I think, as the biggest piece of research in social science, let alone specifically education. And it was in America, 1970s, where they tested a whole range of interventions. Some of those interventions were specifically academic, and in particular were thinking about things like capital letter direct instruction. And some of those interventions were specifically aimed at things like self-esteem. And they found that the programs which had a specifically academic intention, not only did they succeed in raising students' academic attainment, they also succeeded in raising measures of self-esteem. Whereas interventions that were specifically intended to target self-esteem generally failed to raise academic attainment, but also, interestingly, failed to raise measures of self-esteem, and in some cases actually had a negative impact on self-esteem. And the project follow through in particular was looking at the direct instruction stuff, which had high impact on academic outcomes and high impact on measures of self-esteem. And I think the point here is that if kids do well in terms of their academic stuff in school, it has a positive impact on their well-being. It has a positive impact on their self-esteem. It, you know, it's true of all of us, isn't it? If we feel that we're doing well, it's going to make us feel better. Whereas if we feel we're struggling or we're failing, that's going to have a detrimental impact. And I would link this back to Rosenshine, who talks about making sure that children have opportunities for success, and that's acknowledged and that's recognised. Because those opportunities for success that are recognised and acknowledged will ultimately have a positive impact on student well-being.
Definitely.
Which then, I guess it becomes a feedback loop where if then they're having high self-esteem because they've done well, then they are more likely to continue to succeed academically too.
Absolutely. Right. So we're going to get into what is undoubtedly going to be my favourite chapter now. So we're going to wade into behaviour. So we've mentioned and referenced research at a couple of times. And on the rare occasions that I'm asked to go and speak to a largely empty room of people, I do talk about behaviour. And I don't talk about behaviour as, you know, any kind of guru about behaviour. But what I do is, and I think it's going to be similar to, well, obviously not as good as your chapter, Steve, but very similar too. I have a talk called Behavior, Ideology, Evidence and Pragmatism, which is kind of talking about all the different evidence base for behavior. So I use the EES guidance report and the sources from that and compare it to leading voices in behavior and try and find a middle ground somewhere. So it looks to me in this chapter that you've talked about quite a few different approaches and then some practicalities about them. So if we can go through, do you want to kind of outline, you know, some of the approaches to behavior management that you talk about in this chapter?
So we look at for example, we have a look at some of the literature around behaviorism, around behaviorist approaches to behavior management, because that is often sort of held up as being examples of evil practice, not just bad practice, but evil practice. Again, the discourse on Twitter, you often see, you know, behaviorism as demonized, really. So we look at some of the stuff around that. Ultimately, with this chapter, what was really interesting is to look at, you mentioned some of the leading voices, and often, again, in the discourses, you see put in juxtaposition against each other things like, on the one hand, zero tolerance, and on the other hand, restorative practice. So we talk a little bit about those two kind of extremes, and that perhaps actually just sticking with one of those extremes as your policy or practice might not really be the most effective approach. The most effective approach is likely to actually be somewhere in the middle, where your zero tolerance is actually, what that means is, you know, we're not going to tolerate violent behavior, but that's not to say that we are just going to sort of kick everybody out who is aggressive. You know, it's an understanding that children have complex needs and so on and so forth. You know, what is this policy actually doing for us? Why am I doing this particular sort of stuff in the classroom? And is it the best approach that we can take? Because so many of the things that we do in school, and particularly in the pastoral, we do by kind of gut instinct. But actually, you know, I one of the questions I often raise in talks that I give is, how many school policy documents include a reference list? And I could guess that the answer would be quite low numbers. I'm not necessarily saying that policy documents necessarily should, but it would at least give in an indication that there's been some proper thought about why we do things in school.
Yeah, completely. I mean, if you look at something like a behaviour policy, for example, and you think about the people that are involved in formulating a behaviour policy, where are they likely to get that information from? It's probably going to be from the previous school that they worked at, or the school down the road, or another school within the trust, which, you know, working in trust, I've worked in different trusts, you can have hugely different contextual needs for schools within a trust if they're not in the same geographic area, for example. And you think there, you know, if you are looking at the evidence and research base behind this and considering it carefully, and yeah, why don't you put a reference list on there? Because it helps take, you know, the kind of ideology out of it to a certain extent, doesn't it? And be more pragmatic, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gives people at least a sense of kind of foundation. Even if that sort of foundation is in part ideological, you know, at least if you can say, well, you know, we do this, we use restorative practices because of this set of texts, and we found that it works in our school because of this, then, you know, okay. That's the kind of primary thing, really, is just deep thinking about everything we do in school, I think.
And if you don't, and I mean, I think I'm quoting Dylan William correct about lethal mutations, you know, you do see this in pastoral care as well, in terms of, right, I've read a book on, and you gave an example there. So let's say you've read a book on restorative practice, hugely important, something that you can definitely work into your policies, and something that, you know, I personally use quite a lot in the school we're in, we use as well. But taken in isolation because you just read that book and then immediately implemented will cause huge issues. If you've gone from a system where you relied on sanctions to immediately ditching the sanctions and relying on restorative practice.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's not what anybody who's written a book that I've read about restorative practice suggests anyway.
Yeah. And this is really, really important, because so many of the things that get talked about in relation to any of these strategies and interventions are usually based on misreadings or misinterpretations. And certainly that was, you know, I was guilty of that when it came to the work of Paul Dix, right? And when I actually read the book, I was kind of thinking, okay, I see where he's coming from with this stuff now. And that's not to say I necessarily agree with everything that's in there. But one of the questions that I think we should ask is, okay, why are we doing what we do? Why do I want to do this particular intervention, this particular thing? What do people who like this intervention say? And what do people who disagree with them say? Where are the lines of disagreement? What would somebody who's challenging my view say? Now, of course, the difficulty is that in school, when are you going to find time to do any of this stuff? And that's the big issue, because, you know, we are dealing with the day-to-day stuff of teaching lessons and responding to issues as they arise. That, you know, the idea of spare time within a day to do this reading, incredibly difficult. So one of the things that I would strongly urge all schools to do is to have at least one person in their school who is tasked with maybe being a research champion type figure, somebody who is a frame of reference that at least can point people in the right direction for any questions that they've got. You know, we're not trained to do literature reviews. We're not trained to delve into the statistical analysis of intervention work. You know, we're not there. And I know that you've got things like the EEF who kind of exist to help wade through some of that stuff. And those are really, really useful resources. So I think, you know, the more of that sort of stuff that we can use, the better as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, not to try and publicize the podcast anymore, because obviously whoever's listening to it has already seen it, but this is the reason for the existence of this podcast and others was, you know, originally, and you may know this, Steve, was originally just to publicize the kind of work of a research school. Yeah. It was to give an introduction and a gateway into, you know, a book. So if the people are reading, listen to this and then say, right, I want to go and read Steve's book. And then obviously you've referenced quite a lot of further reading and things on there. So hopefully these kind of things are creating that culture where people are becoming, you know, as we try to say, more critical consumers of evidence-based practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, at the beginning of the podcast, in the introduction, you were kind of talking about how there's plenty of stuff out there. In fact, I was listening to the podcast that you released this week with Maria, and how she kind of began with this huge challenge, really, of where is the stuff on pastoral? Where is it? It's not there. You know, there's plenty of stuff on approaches to pedagogy. There's a lot of stuff that's come out over the last few years about building a curriculum. Where's the central place to look for pastoral things? And you know, that was, and still remains, actually, quite an issue, I think, for schools.
Definitely. And speaking of Maria, we're talking in the next one about character education. So we talked briefly about that with Maria as well. So how do you define character education, and what kind of things do we need to do around that kind of topic?
I'm very reluctant to define it, actually. Yeah. And one of the, I'm much happier kind of criticising other people's definitions.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers with Teacher Hug Radio, the soundtrack to your teaching career.
I think that one of the difficulties with character education is that it is kind of nebulous in terms of a thing. You know, is it a concrete curriculum artifact? Is it something that's a teachable thing? Certainly, the Jubilee Centre for Character and Education at the University of Birmingham think that it is. And if you're interested in character education, then the Jubilee Centre is a really good place to look. They've got a lot of resources, quite concrete resources, things that you can actually use in lessons with kids. And I refer to one of them, I outline one of them in the book, that we've used in the teaching of English, for example. Some of the terms that are kind of associated with character education are slightly problematic. So things like grit and resilience, I'm slightly uncomfortable with, because they have a kind of hint of, well, first of all, ambiguity in some respects, but also this notion of resilience and grit of being quite stoic and just getting on with it and all that kind of stuff, which I'm not entirely sure is necessarily all that helpful. For me, ideas about character education are really about thinking about, well, what kind of people do we want our students to be? What kind of people do we want them to become? What kind of people do we want ourselves to be? One of the words that I love is comes from the German, which is Bildung, which is this notion of having a sense of personal character, but not these traits like resilience and things, but more just a way of being. For me, it's about a way of being and a way of doing, which I know is just as nebulous as where we started, but it's about the stuff that you do. A colleague of mine often sort of says good character, ethical leadership is about the things that you do when no one is looking. The way that you behave when no one is watching. And that's kind of what I think gets to the heart of good character education, really.
Yeah, really good, really good. So last little bit before we step into the vinyl suite, and I feel a bit guilty, Steve, because we've had quite an in-depth, educated discussion today, and I'm going to trivialise it by going into the vinyl suite and talking music.
Nothing trivial about popular music.
Well, okay then. So before we do that, just the last chapter is about remote pastoral. So obviously, we're at the moment, as we're recording this, so we're fully back into school and everything seems to be ticking along nicely. But obviously, that chapter doesn't just talk about what kind of things we will do, should we be in another situation where we're homeschooling. That talks about more than just that. So give us some kind of key areas that you're talking about with remote pastoral.
Yeah, so this chapter came, obviously, the book had been written, and we were going through the sort of editing stages just as we were kind of going into lockdown one, and we felt that it would probably be just a good idea just to pick up on some of the thoughts there. It's quite a short chapter, but it highlights, I think, some of the things that had emerged from things that I'd seen people talking about, the issues that they were having during that first lockdown, which I'm not sure if they emerged again during the recent lockdowns, but things like keeping in touch with students and their families. For some students, you know, if you were doing lots of kind of, if you were continuing to deliver your lessons, your curriculum online, how are you in the, ensuring that students were accessing that? How were you maintaining contact with the students who you knew were vulnerable? How were you keeping in touch with the families who maybe were struggling? But more than that, actually, how were you making sure that you were keeping in touch with the students who you didn't even know were vulnerable? Because we don't know all of the vulnerabilities that kids have. So the first kind of thing that I would emphasize there is about making sure, finding some way of making sure that you've got decent up-to-date contacts for your students and their families. There were things that emerged during the lockdowns that would never have occurred to us had we just been in normal school time. And, I'm sure that everybody's got pupils that they can think of that they didn't know were struggling with something at home until lockdown happened. So those points of contact were really important. One of the other things, I mean, obviously just communication generally, but also I'm based at a cathedral school, a Christian school. And so one of the words that I've kind of borrowed from religious language is the word congregation, which, you know, is so important in any community, particularly in a school community. I talked earlier about the importance of coming together in assemblies. How do you provide that sense of congregation when your students are all at home? Can you do that effectively through Zoom? Is there some other mechanism that you can do? So that was one of the questions that I raised as well. And the main thing that I've put was just about looking after each other, because it was hard on the kids and it was hard on all of the staff too, and it was hard on the parents and it was hard on the families. So it was just about making sure that you've got that awareness of each other, really, and making sure that, you know, everybody was able to contact somebody if they were struggling.
Yeah. And I mean, in terms of positives from, not that I'm trying to say there's any positives from a pandemic situation, but positives from the pastoral side of it has been, you know, up-to-date contact details, as you've talked about, more flexible ways of getting in touch. Now, we think nothing now of having a parental meeting on a Zoom, obviously, with all appropriate safeguarding concerns taken into account. Any kind of conferences with agency involvement are now involved with, generally speaking, online. And you do start to think, well, why did all professionals zoom around in the cars to different locations four and five times a day?
Why were they flying around everywhere? Why were they, and, you know, where I live, we're going to be quite seriously affected over the next few years by the works for building this new railway, the HS2. And then by the time that's been completed, are people even going to be using trains to get to meetings and stuff now? There won't be any need for it, but anyway. Certainly there's been some positives, and I think that that the technology has really enabled some of that communication. It's raised questions equally, though, in terms of access to that technology. You know, I know of kids who are doing their online learning through an iPhone, for example, but it's not, you know, when you're trying to do a team meeting at the same time as trying to use a Word app on a small device like that, not particularly ideal. So there were issues there, I guess, too.
Academers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Namers Natter, just talking to teachers.